Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's the largest lockdown in world history. Last week, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi told 1.3 billion Indians that the government was enforcing a national stay-at-home order to get control of the coronavirus pandemic. Just 4 hours later, that lockdown went into effect. The three-week order is forcing many of India's poor migrant workers in the country's largest cities to make a choice: go hungry or risk police harassment by trying to return home. Now, India overall is vast, as is the scale of this effort. So what is at stake for India and the world? This hour on Point, India and its response to coronavirus. Well, we will begin today with Barkha Dutt. She is editor of the digital platform Mojo. She's also a columnist for The Washington Post, and her latest piece there is titled, "As India Goes Into Lockdown, Fear Spreads That Poverty May Kill Us First." And she joins us from New Delhi. Barkha Dutt, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
And I should note that Barkha is joining us today via Skype. Barkha, will you first describe to us, I mean, Delhi itself, New Delhi, or Delhi has 19 million people in it. Just what is the view like just outside where you are in the streets of Delhi right now?
Well, Meghna, I think that number should give your listeners a sense of the scale of what we're dealing with. This is the world's most populated country. We're talking about 1.3 billion people, and just the city is the country's capital, as you mentioned, has 19 million people. But the story is really unfolding, Meghna, at the borders of India's capital. For the past 6 days, I've been walking little stretches of the way with poor workers. These are our most marginalized, our poorest people. And just to give you a number, we have 45 million migrant workers. What do migrant workers mean? It means they live in villages, but they come to work in the cities, and they have temporary places of accommodation, let's say at a construction site where somebody's carrying bricks or breaking cement. Typically, that's the sort of daily wager job description that we're talking about, and that number adds up to 45 million. And over the last 6 days, we have seen these people. I've met a man who was carrying his five-year-old child on his head and walking, you know, hundreds of miles to reach his village. Another child who was 8 years old, who, you know, it was just unspeakable, the kind of images that we've seen. These are people with very little money. And because public transport has been shut, I just want your listeners to understand this. Unlike other countries, let's say like the United States, that have gone into lockdown, parts of it at least, public transport in your part of the world is open. Here, public transport has been virtually shut except for skeletal bus services in places. So these are men and women and children, walking on foot for hundreds of miles. And it took 3 days for consistent media pressure to get buses for them. And then when the buses came, there was a deluge of people, which then became the opposite of a lockdown. So it's been chaotic and it's been tragic.
And so why did that happen, right? Because when Prime Minister Modi announced the lockdown, the purpose, the intent was to keep everyone in their homes. But of course, as you're saying, these 45 million migrant workers, their actual homes were hundreds of kilometers from the cities in India where they were working. So was there a sort of a failure of planning here?
Well, I would have to say that this is a failure of planning, because when the Prime Minister has made two national addresses. The first one was a kind of rallying call. He, in fact, called it a people's curfew, and he asked everybody to come out on their balconies and applaud all the sort of first responders and the frontline warriors in this battle against corona. And everybody, including myself, said, that was a great speech. The second speech that announced the lockdown came at about 8 p.m. India time, and by midnight, the lockdown was supposed to kick in. Most of us understood the inevitability of the lockdown, given the contagion effect of the coronavirus or the COVID-19. But I think what we did not factor in is that you know, India's poor would not be factored into this lockdown, that no time would be given to plan for them, that nobody would have anticipated that these are such poor people. So just to understand, what's happened is that those who employ them effectively told them there's no work happening. And because they get wages on a daily basis, they were basically told that they would not be paid anymore, right? So these are people who earn like 300 to 400 rupees a day. And I'm doing a quick calculation to say that's about $5. If they're lucky, that's what they get. And they have, you know, they often live at the site where they work. So they don't have permanent homes. So if they have employers who throw them out or landlords who say, just get out now because you can't pay the rent, their earning capacity is decided day by day. So they went into panic. And of course, the human instinct for everybody, right, is to want to go home. And that's across classes. That's across nations. When something like this happens, you want to go home. So they had an economic response and they had an emotional response. And it has been, I have to say, the lockdown is not what people are criticizing. The lockdown is seen by all of us as inevitable and essential. It is forgetting India's poor and then almost blaming them for moving that I think has disturbed so many of us.
I see. Well, I just want to play a little bit of tape here. This is from the BBC. Mohammed Jalal, he was interviewed by the BBC. He told reporters that he feels trapped. So Mohammed in that clip saying it's difficult to find food or a place to sleep anywhere. The police beat us. They tell us to stay in one place. But can we stay hungry? We need to work so we can eat. They have made us prisoners. Barkha, have the rules changed? Has the government modified its response or what it's asking these employers to do for India's migrant workers in the past day or two?
Meghna, indeed it has. So after this sort of tragedy played out and, you know, the country was kind of shocked and bruised by seeing hundreds of thousands of workers walking hundreds of miles with their little children and their sort of one bag of their life's belongings. Finally, about 2 days ago, you had a new order from the government that basically said this movement was a violation of the lockdown and that they should be urged to stay where they are. Now, to make this happen, there's an order that their employers have to pay them full wages. So I went back to the borders to check what was the impact of this new order. And what the workers there told me was first that many of them had walked from different states. So they were already here on foot and with no public transport, they do not know how to go back. As one of them said, do you now want me to walk back? And then when I said, look, there's now an order that your employer will pay you, he virtually laughed and he said, look, who's going to enforce that? It's not like if I go back and my employer doesn't pay me, I'm now going to have the capacity to go to the police. The third problem has been, unfortunately, this beleaguered, overwhelmed, often draconian police force of ours that in some ways has been both perpetrator and victim at different points. But there have been many disturbing instances of the police using force on these poor men and women and literally using their lathis, as we call them, which are wooden sticks, to kind of herd them away, to turn them back. So the policy has changed. They're now being redirected to shelters or they're being asked to go back. But I've been saying throughout that till we open public transport or we increase the amount of public transport, this problem is going to fester. We had a horrific image today of poor workers who had returned to their village in one of our northern states, where local authorities sprayed them with a disinfectant that's meant to clean buses, right? So they were sprayed. And I just can't imagine this being done to the rich, to my class, to people who were, for example, evacuated by air. And there were many Indians who were evacuated and rescued, stranded from across the world. So I think what we're really seeing here is the virus wrenching open our class divide. And I imagine this is true for anybody listening anywhere, that it's always the poorest, it's always the people at the bottom of our very hierarchical societies that have the least access to healthcare and that become invisible in the system. And that's what we're seeing happen here.
This is what we're seeing around the world, right? This pandemic is wrenching open, as you said, truths about a nation that perhaps we had the convenience of ignoring beforehand, but cannot ignore in a pandemic. We'll get back to that in a moment, Barkha. But I have to say, I would like you to help us understand, to visualize India in lockdown, because I'm thinking of all the times I've been to Mumbai, to Delhi, to Kolkata, these great, vast world cities where all of humanity, I always thought like the best and worst of what humanity has to offer is thrown together in India. And I just cannot imagine. I've been trying to imagine for days what Delhi, what Mumbai look like in lockdown. What has that been like?
It's been dystopian. It's been unreal. It's been, I like to call it like every bad Netflix drama come through. Like, I didn't think I would see this in my lifetime. Because I'm a journalist, I'm able to have the credentials to go out. But most people are only allowed to go out to do groceries. You have to be listed as an essential service to be able to get out. So I don't know what it's like in, you know, in the United States. But somewhere here, the lockdown has got conflated with an almost curfew like situation. So you're allowed to go and get groceries. You're allowed to probably take a walk in your neighborhood. But most people cannot step out at all. So, you know, you're being asked pretty much to effectively stay at home. So what that does to this bustling, overpopulated, over-argumentative, loud, bumptious, boisterous nation of mine is that it's very silent. It's very still. Our landmarks are kind of deserted. The only thing, and I think this has been noticed the world over, is that there's this kind of strange reduction in air pollution. I mean, it's strange that I'm even mentioning that, but I've never seen Delhi, which is otherwise the world's most polluted city, because it's been shorn of all its people and its traffic and its cars and its movement. Suddenly we can breathe again. But just the time when we can breathe again, we're all indoors, at least those of us who can't go out. So there's a kind of surreal quality. There's a surreal stillness to it. And you're absolutely right. It's kind of unimaginable for a country like ours. And I think that's why you're now seeing the government already in the fifth day, Meghna, having to say that, you know, the movement of goods, you know, there has been relaxation on those kind of things, because the big fear was that the food supply chain, food security should not be hit. You know, our groceries travel from an agricultural wholesaler's market, and then they have to go to a middleman, and the middleman has to take it to a retailer. So when we order online, we don't know all of this, but I took a trip to one of these, as they call mandis, their wholesale markets, and we saw vegetables piling up and rotting and having to be destroyed. We've seen the same thing happening to our fisheries. So I think the real concern is that this is a country that really cannot deal well with a lockdown. This is an inevitability. This is a very unique situation. But, you know, I think you're going to see a kind of fine tuning and a calibration of this lockdown, because it's not possible to sustain the supply chain of even food, fish, meat, vegetables and eggs and milk otherwise.
Well, Barkhadat, editor of the digital platform Mojo, speaking to us via Skype from New Delhi today. Stand by for just a moment. We have a lot more to talk about what's at stake in India's lockdown for India and for the rest of the world as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are taking a look at India's lockdown in the face of the coronavirus global pandemic. 1.3 billion human beings asked to lock down as India tries to get a hold of the coronavirus epidemic there on the subcontinent. We want to know what your questions are. about what the rest of the world can learn about how the lockdown is happening in India. I'm joined today by Barkha Dutt. She's with us from New Delhi. She's editor of the digital platform Mojo and a columnist for the Washington Post as well. And she's been doing some fantastic frontline reporting from the streets of Delhi about the plight of millions, tens of millions of migrant workers in India. And joining us today as well is Ravi Agrawal. He's with us from New York. He's managing editor of Foreign Policy, and his latest piece is titled South Asia's Looming Disaster. Ravi, welcome to On Point.
Good to be on. Thanks, Meghna.
So first of all, I just want to continue the thread that we were on with Barkha at the end of that, the previous segment, about sort of what does lockdown even look like in a nation like India? I mean, does the every time I have had a chance to visit family there, the thing that is most impressed or impressive to me is how social Indian culture is from top to bottom. I mean, I can't. That's why I think I struggled so much in imagining what lockdown looks like. Like social distancing, can that even be a thing in a place like India?
Well, there's the general social cultural reason why lockdowns would be hard for Indians. But I think more than just the cultural angles, I think it's the class angles that bother me a lot more about how India might be coping with this. I think if you're rich or if you're upper middle class in India, and again, I should caveat that by saying that the upper middle class in India is quite small, as is the sort of the upper tier of the middle class in the cities. For those people who have apartments and homes and maybe have separate rooms, social distancing is one thing. But I think for the vast majority of Indians who live in apartments and homes that are much smaller, you can go a layer down then to people who live in packed slums, say in Mumbai's Dharavi or in slums in Calcutta, and then you can begin to imagine how difficult it is for any of them to be able to practice real social distancing among families even when you have many people packed inside small apartments. You add to that the fact that there are so many homeless people in India, about 1.7 million officially homeless, but the numbers are likely far higher. And then add to that the fact that Barkha was describing, which is that there are so many migrant workers trying to get back. So you add all of these things together, and I think the lockdown on paper sounds great. But the reality is far more complicated in terms of how people are going to get the things they need to do what they need to do in this moment, which is to flatten the curve.
Right. And so, I mean, that's what Barkha was talking about the concerns about the supply chain. I mean, we're talking, in addition to that, millions of Indians without even, say, refrigeration in their homes.
Exactly, which is, I mean, I think the way to frame this is that you imagine all the problems, the normal problems that people in the West are having with a lockdown, with social distancing, with working from home, with staying home for as long as they are. And you can multiply that by many factors to imagine what India is feeling at large, and especially what India's middle class and lower middle class is feeling in this moment. For many of them, it is very hard to be able to prepare for a moment like this. And remember, again, as Barkha said, the announcement came with just 4 hours' notice. So there was a real lack of forward planning, a lot of policy being made on the fly, very little care and thought going into people who don't have the means to stay home for as long as the government may require it to. And then the second and third order problems from this are only far worse in terms of if community spread has already begun in India, then, you know, the official cases, which are currently at about 1,000, just over 1,000, they could explode once India begins to test more. India has still only conducted about 35,000 tests, which is, you know, a fraction of the 500,000 that the United States has conducted so far. And India, of course, has a population that is 4 times as large. So if this begins to spread, especially through migrant workers who are now trying to head home, through other people who are unable to manage this curfew and have to step out, or to people who are living tightly packed in close quarters and slums across India, for all of those people, when community spread occurs, India faces real disasters. And the main reason here, of course, is that India's healthcare system is very weak. This is a country that spends just 3.7% of its GDP on healthcare. China spends twice as much. Italy spends three times as much. And India has just 5 hospital beds for every 10,000 people. The UK has 5 times as many per person. Italy has 6 times as many per person. So if this gets bad, as with all crises in India, it'll get really bad.
Right. I mean, this is a disease, a pandemic that's challenging every nation. The United States spends 20% of its GDP on healthcare, and still we got caught behind the eight ball as well. Barkha, let me ask you, on that note, there has been, in all fairness, there has been rigorous and necessary questioning here in the United States about the U.S.'s belated response at the federal level for a global pandemic that we saw coming. That is a conversation and questioning that must continue here. Have the same questions been asked in India? Because, I mean, Ravi has written that he believes, and he's not the only one, that the lockdown is not only the right thing to do, but it should have happened a lot earlier in India.
I think I would agree with that to the extent that certain sort of delays are inexplicable. And let me give you one example. I know that doctors and health workers in the United States are talking all the time about personal protective equipment. That's, you know, what they need to wear to keep themselves safe. In India, every doctor that I've spoken to is talking about a shortage of this. Even Air India pilots that were sent to evacuate Indian stranded are saying that the protective equipment that they were given was not strong enough, or there wasn't enough sanitizer, or there wasn't enough, you know, the things that people need to keep themselves safe when they're first responders. When I interviewed, we interviewed the gentleman who heads the association that produces medical devices, and he said for 1 month he could not get the specifications needed from the government on the personal protective equipment, right? So we lost a month there. We've only just asked for kits to be produced to do antibodies tests. So this was something that should have happened long ago. And India's parliament, Meghna, this is I want to say it's an interesting story, but it's also actually points to the dangers of the delay. India's parliament was functioning right up until a couple of days before the lockdown was declared, before we decided to shut down, before the airports were shut down. And a lot of questions were raised about why parliament was functioning. In fact, we even had a member of parliament who spent an evening with somebody who was a confirmed COVID case. And then there was this panic about how he may have infected other people. So he went into isolation, but parliament still did not shut down. And it wasn't as if Parliament was meeting to discuss the coronavirus preparations. It was discussing other things. So I definitely think that there was a delay. We as a country were quick to seal our borders. I think we were quicker than most countries in the world. So we did well on that front. Mm. But internally, in terms of testing, in terms of having enough testing kits, in terms of personal protective equipment, and in terms of factoring in the poor, and leaving yourself 2 or 3 days to go through drills, we left ourselves no time. We were, we're kind of in a catch-up mode because we left it, I think, somewhat later than we should have, certainly.
Interesting. Well, Ravi, let me turn back to you for a moment, because you've written also that this isn't just an India issue, but you're looking at it more holistically as a South Asia challenge right now. Why is that?
Sure. I mean, part of the reason why I do that is because, I have a newsletter that looks at the region, but India's neighbors are quite similar in terms of demographics, in terms of the other problems that they face in terms of infrastructure and healthcare preparedness. And they are also quite large countries by way of population. So you look at Pakistan, which has more than 200 million people and borders, both Iran and China, which are two countries, as you know, that have had very, very serious outbreaks. Bangladesh also has about 160 million people and has ties with both India, but also with China and other countries in the region. So these are all countries that I think have similar problems, where the minute you have community spread, there is a propensity for things to get far worse than they would otherwise get in the West. Mm. And these range from the general sort of ability and preparedness of the healthcare system, of personal preparedness equipment, masks and all of those things, but also just the availability of doctors, the availability of hospital beds, The fact that in these economies, there's a very high percentage of workers who work in what is called the informal sector, which means that they don't really have fixed contracts, they don't have pensions or benefits or healthcare plans, and all of those things mean that they are far more vulnerable in a situation like this. So India, for example, has tried to put in place some, belatedly, some measures that would protect workers. But again, it's very hard to imagine how, if you are, say, a rickshaw puller or you are a maid who works at someone's home and you don't have any paperwork, you may not have a bank account, for all of those people then to be able to live day to day as daily wage laborers is very difficult. So staying home in that sense is next to impossible. It's one thing if you're in a rich country and everyone has supplies and fridges and kitchens, and the means and the education and the literacy to be able to deal with what it means to stay at home. It is quite another thing for the entire region of South Asia, which is about 1.8 billion people, one-fourth of the world's population.
Mm. Well, Ravi and Barkha, stand by for just a moment because I really want to dig in more into the potential outcomes of coronavirus in India in particular. And to help us do that, we're joined now by Ramanan Lakshminarayan. He's with us from New Delhi. He's director of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics and Policy in both Washington and New Delhi. He's also a senior research scholar at Princeton University. And he recently wrote a piece in the New York Times headlined, What India Needs to Fight This Virus. Ramanan, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So you have been working with other researchers for a while on a pretty sophisticated large-scale model of the Indian population, right? And you've been looking at what might happen if a catastrophe or a major challenge, to put it lightly, like coronavirus were to hit. What is that model telling you about what could happen in India?
The model, suite of models, really, it's not just one model. And what they basically do is mimic the Indian population. And we've used that for many things like vaccine introductions into India, as well as, you know, studying the health system in India. And what we have here is a virus to which no Indian has immunity. And it's literally like setting fire in, in a forest of just dry wood. So, we managed to block the borders pretty early, but it still has probably gotten in. And without the lockdown that's currently in place, we had originally estimated over 300 million infections. Now, most of these would be without symptoms and also would be mild infections. But even so, that small proportion that would be severe could have been quite large compared to India's capacity. Now, with the lockdown, we're estimating that that's probably going to come down at least by half, probably as much as by 70 or 70%. It really depends. It depends on how well the lockdowns actually worked, and we're looking for more data. But even so, what we're left with, which will be a peak sometime in May or June, would still be in the order of about, you know, needing about 800,000 to about 1.5 million hospitalizations. And India only has about 100,000 ICU beds. So, as you've heard from the others, it's a tough situation here. And even though the lockdown has imposed a lot of costs, it's bought us some time to prepare for the epidemic.
Mm-hmm. But as you said, the numbers are still vast. And does these models obviously account for example, things that Barkha was telling us earlier about the sort of long-term health impacts of the poor air quality in some Indian cities. There's also high rates of tuberculosis, smoking, sort of these comorbid factors that are leading some people to suffer extremely or even be fatalities in the coronavirus epidemic.
So a lot of things going against India's population. One is certainly that respiratory illnesses and air quality and smoking. The other is that although rates of severe disease or even hospitalizations in children has been very small in other countries, Italy doesn't have that many kids. China has pretty well-nourished children. In India, we've got a large population of kids under five, about 130 million kids under the age of five. So there's a lot of unknowns here. We don't know what this virus will do to the Indian population. It might be better than what we expect, and we're hopeful and optimistic for that. But it could also be worse because we generally have a population that doesn't do well with respect to infections because of undernutrition and other, you know, deprivations. So we're waiting to see, but we're assuming that you know, we have to prepare for something that's really tough, but hope for the best.
Yeah. So you said that the peak in India may be May or June. So we're talking 6 to 8 weeks out. And India is just at the beginning of a 3-week lockdown. So what does India need to accomplish in that 3 weeks to help keep the numbers as down as possible when it peaks in this later in the spring?
So just to explain, the 3-week lockdown right now has the effect of cutting down the transmission of the virus so that even just with this 3-week lockdown, we'll still have pushed out the peak and pushed it down into April, into May or June. If we had not done the lockdown, we would have had to face a much higher peak at the end of April. So I'm not saying we need another lockdown, but this lockdown itself would have achieved that purpose. But again, there's still a lot to prepare for. And what India needs to do is use this period of lockdown to track, test, and contain diseases in small clusters. They're probably in urban areas, probably in your airports, because like with the US, the disease came in from the outside. It came in through wealthy people or people who had traveled abroad. And so it wasn't automatically in the villages. And so most of our clusters are probably still in the urban areas.
So do you see the possibility? I mean, is India already doing that, creating the infrastructure or using the infrastructure it has to do that deep tracking and testing?
So India is, as you know, it's a highly heterogeneous country. We've got Kerala, which has health indicators as good, you know, better than New York City. And we've got, you know, Bihar and Jharkhand, which are, you know, as badly off as Sierra Leone. We've got all of that inside one country. So it's, and health is really something that's up to the states to a large extent. So the southern states are very proactive. They've got the manpower. And as other people have said, you can't build a public health system for an emergency in the middle of the emergency. So the states that have built that public health system are going to do well. The states that have not are going to find it quite challenging.
Right. Well, Ramanan Lakshminarayan, stand by, and Ravi Agrawal and Barkha Dutt as well. We are talking about the world's most populous country and the world's biggest democracy under lockdown to fight coronavirus and what that looks like in India and what's at stake for India and the rest of the world. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about India in lockdown to fight coronavirus and what it looks like when 1.3 billion people are asked to stay home. I'm joined today by Ramanan Lakshminarayan. He's director of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics and Policy in both Washington and New Delhi. And he joins us today from New Delhi. Ravi Agrawal joins us as well from New York. He's managing editor of Foreign Policy. And Barkha Dutt is with us via Skype from New Delhi. She's editor of the digital platform Mojo. And Barkha, I wanted to just ask you a follow-up question to something that Ramanan has written about, that there are, as he mentioned earlier, there's sort of a state-by-state response happening in India, which in a way is parallel or analogous to what we have here in the United States. So maybe perhaps that's a good comparison versus India and China, for example. But has there been a push at the federal level, at the national level in India, to do the things that will be needed in, say, the more impoverished states, build more healthcare facilities, get more equipment, ventilators, that kind of thing?
So, Meghna, one of the things that has been done is that the Indian Railways, which is probably the largest railway network in the world in terms of how many people it ferries every day, the railway service, your listeners should know, has been completely suspended. And train coaches have now been converted into possible isolation wards. So I think there is that kind of anticipation or preparing for the worst case scenario, even as everybody hopes and prays that it doesn't come upon us. I think Ramanan is absolutely right that how states have responded has varied from state to state. And I know you're seeing that, you know, in the United States as well. But I'm of the personal opinion that you do still need a kind of centralized coordination because of the nature of our country and the way power is structured, and also that many people live in one state but perhaps work in another. And because our borders have been sealed and public transport, as I was mentioning, has been curtailed, one of the reasons we had this absolute tragedy unfold with the migrant workers is because there was no coordination between the different state governments. It was almost as if every state wanted to pass on the problem of these poor onto the next state. And so while, the federal structure does help in terms of every state kind of looking after its own backyard, we're the kind of country where you do need much more sort of overseeing in terms of how the states are coordinating amongst themselves. And I'm afraid this is where I think if we'd had just a bit more time, if the lockdown had kicked in earlier, if the states had, let's say, 4 days to talk amongst themselves and, you know, there was some sort of agreement on what to do next, and how to do it, I think we would have had a better execution of this lockdown, where really every day the government has to introduce maybe a modification based on what they're seeing on the ground. And Meghna, I just wanted to mention one other thing, this idea of social distancing in a country as unequal as ours. 92 million households in India live in one-room houses. Homes, 92 million households. So this can often mean 5 or 6 or 7 people in one room, right? And I think that even when we tell people stay at home, I mean, I went out 2 hours out of the capital today and I was in the fields talking to farmers, and that was actually the safest I'd felt because it was open space and people weren't congested together. Because actually for some people, stay at home is a problem if there has been community transmission, if in, you know, one member or in the neighborhood. Stay at home is not always safe in a country where millions of people live in one room.
Yeah, you know, Barkha, to be full disclosure, you're talking about my family. Every time I go to visit India, we're a one-room family.
We also like to be a one-room family, right? That's also a problem. Even if we have a second room, we like huddling together. So there's a cultural dimension to this, but there's also an economic dimension.
Well, and also, I mean, you get a firsthand, for people who obviously haven't lived or grown up in India, you get, upon visiting places like that, whenever I visit my family, I get a firsthand experience of what truly living cheek by jowl actually mean, sort of down to the daily level of everyone sleeping together in one room. And that's a truth for tens of millions of Indians, as you're saying, every day. Ravi, let me turn back to you here, because, you know, we could say, look, China, once it got past its sort of paranoid secrecy around the start of the coronavirus pandemic, the strength, quote unquote, strength of an authoritarian system of government shown through in China's response and how it tried to control the spread of coronavirus in China. But of course, in both India and the United States case, we're talking about democracies. So I'm wondering what you see as being revealed about Indian democracy now and how it's approaching trying to fight coronavirus.
Yeah, that's one of the strange things because, you know, I mean, democracies are messy by definition, and so it's much harder to impose any form of sort of draconian rules. Although in India's case, I think it has unveiled one of the most draconian lockdowns in the world, certainly for the largest population. And so in that sense, it is doing more than what even China did. But I think the key difference when comparing India and China is that China is just a much richer country. The GDP per capita in India, for example, is about $2,000 a person per year. And in China, it's about 4 times that amount. So the average Chinese is just far better educated, has more space. They live in smaller families, of course, for a variety of reasons, more likely to have fridges at home, more likely to also comply with these kinds of orders. They are better policed, better monitored, better surveilled in general than the Indian population. So for all of those reasons, I think China's outcomes were destined to be a bit better than India's seemed to be, I think, on paper. A lot depends in the next few weeks on how seriously people are able to take this lockdown and also how they're able to survive it in their homes. As Barkha was saying and you were saying, it's one thing to have five or six people living in a room, but what that does, despite the joys of hanging out together, is that you are as clean and as safe as the weakest link in that room. So all it takes is for one of those people to step out, for one of those people to get infected because they got bored. And remember, for many of these families in India, they may not have TVs. Only half of all Indians have access to the internet, for example. I mean, for all the complaining that all of us are doing in the West, we have the internet, we have the ability to have things delivered, we have more space, we have clean air. I mean, these are all things that are just so much harder for people to do across India and indeed across South Asia. So I'm deeply worried about the outcomes there, especially if community spread has taken place. I'm deeply worried about people getting through this time, about being able to sort of just get their calories every day, to get some exercise, to entertain themselves. Mental health will become a huge issue in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
I'm very worried.
Well, so Ramanan, you, all three of you today have talked about what essentially amounts to the potential of for a double whammy to hit India. There's the direct impact of coronavirus itself, and then there's the sort of subsequent impact of hunger, poverty, lack of food for tens, if not hundreds of millions of Indians. So what needs to be done to mitigate that second potential disaster in the country?
Right. So Meghna, I wrote about this in the New York Times when I said there is a secondary, poverty and hunger crisis. But there's something I didn't write about, which is beyond that, which is all of our current problems with respect to tuberculosis, pneumonia, all that stuff didn't take a break just because of coronavirus. All that is continuing. And meanwhile, a lot of the health budget, and correctly so, is gone towards fighting coronavirus. In West Africa, for instance, after the Ebola outbreak, they lost a lot of healthcare providers. For nearly 3 years, their measles immunization rates came down. So there are knock-on effects that happen. And, you know, I'm really praying that our healthcare providers stay as safe as we can possibly keep them, because we cannot afford to lose healthcare providers. That means, lots of other things won't happen after this wave has passed, particularly in immunization, which we've done a lot better in the last few years compared to ourselves, but still a long way to go. I think there's also, the joblessness, which is the other big deal, which, there's lots of layoffs going to happen across the country. It's only but natural that, stopping an economy the size of India's and the complexity of India's is like stopping a machine with lots of little gears and cogs, and it's all come to a complete stop. To get that entire machinery working, someone to be able to order supplies, they're going to have to get money from someone else. Getting that entire machinery going could take months, if not even longer than that. And in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of people that are out of work, and that's going to be a knock-on effect. Now, of course, people might blame the lockdown for it. And the one thing I want to say is that it's a tough measure, but, politicians or governments never get credit for stuff that they do that the public doesn't get to observe. Now, this government will never get credit for, I'm just saying that there is something that is happening now because of the lockdown, which is we're not hit with, this huge waves of hospitalizations and deaths. That's not going to be observable to the population. What the population will observe is, yes, there was an epidemic, but also, they killed our economy and we're all out of jobs. And that's usually the perception which prevents people from doing a lockdown in the first place.
Right. Well, Barkha, let me turn back to you on that, because what Ramanan just said obviously echoes very familiar here in the United States as well. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, these are universal dilemmas for any government that has to go into this kind of, extreme measure. And I take Ramanan's point the government perhaps sometimes doesn't get enough credit for taking risk. But I would say that these are two separate issues. The lockdown per se and the need to do it is one issue. And how well you can or do prepare for it is another issue. So I'll give you just a small example. We had essential services that were allowed to move, but somebody forgot to include fish in it. 26% little under 27% of rural India consumes fish. So you have fish workers now having to destroy fish because they don't have enough ice to store the fish that they catch from the sea. Another example, speaking as a woman, somebody forgot the sanitary pads are essential items. I'm giving you very tiny examples. I'm not putting the entire government on the mat. I'm saying people's day-to-day lives, livelihoods, you know, they have to be thought of. They have to be factored in. And the problem that happened with this is that there wasn't enough time to plan anything. So what people are reacting to is not the lockdown. A lot of people give credit to Prime Minister Modi for being firm, for being bold, for taking a risk. But I think it was really befuddling that everybody just forgot that there were 45 million migrant workers. Everybody just forgot that 14 million Indians work in the, you know, in the fishery sector. Everybody just forgot that, you know, you need a way to get vegetables to the towns. So these are just basic governance issues. And I know a lot of things are being modified and smoothened out. But I think that people do respond to execution and not just the idea of the lockdown.
Right, because, I mean, the execution of a major effort like this is what people are experiencing in their day-to-day lives.
That's
I would say that's the best and only means for them to judge how effective a major lockdown like this is. Ravi, given sort of what we've talked about in terms of how India entered the lockdown, at the end of the 21 days, just presuming for a moment, we don't know for sure if Prime Minister Modi will decide to lift the lockdown after 21 days. But what's the best way to unwind then from this slowly to get the Indian economy going again? I mean, that's a question that we're facing here in the United States as well.
I mean, and that's an answer that I think most economies are wondering at the same time. I think, India especially is going to struggle to bring the economy back because of how many people work in non-traditional informal sectors where, the number of layoffs, for example, will not be accounted for in government data immediately. So it's just going to be very hard to unwind all of that kind of stuff. This is, Ramanan used the analogy of a giant machine where all the cogs are stopping, except this isn't just one machine. These were sort of many disparate machines that weren't always connected properly or had tenuous connections. And so you have to, in a sense, remake those connections. I mean, for migrant workers, for example, if they make it back home to their villages, getting back and then finding the same jobs may not be easy because there's just going to be a huge amount of churn whenever the Indian economy comes back online. But I think my hope out of all of this is that any decisions that are made now in the coming weeks need to be clearly signaled, clearly telegraphed ahead of time. There need to be plans put in place between states to get the transport moving ahead of time, to get supply chains up and running. I think those are things that the government now realizes it could have done a better job on before it announced this lockdown. And I think those are things that people will ask tough questions about. And I think the signs so far, the government is trying to say that this lockdown is going to be enough, but we simply don't know. And I think a real approach of humility on the part of elected leaders is going to be very necessary in this moment, not just humility, but also real honesty. Because I think in general, populations around the world can take honesty from leaders. We need to know the worst. We need to steel ourselves for the worst to prepare for it.
Well, Ramanan, just briefly, as we wind down this conversation, what indicators will you be looking for in the coming days and weeks that would give a good sense of how India is managing coronavirus in that nation?
So a few things, just a couple, actually. So one is we still don't know what the epidemic curve looks like because India's not tested that much, as you heard before. So our data are extremely limited and we really don't have eyes on the ground. And it's hard to fight this war without that intelligence. We're looking for data to see how many people actually have antibodies to the virus. It is possible, and one of the things working for India is that India has a relatively large young population relative to to the China or Italy. And only 6% of India's population is above the age of 65. So we're hoping that the virus may have spread amongst this population, created a large pool of immunes, and in that way, it's able to sort of, you know, prevent a big mortality burden as we sort of go along. So that's a major indicator, but I think, you know, stay tuned. We're all hoping and working hard, and the government is has botched a few things, but is also working hard for preparation.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll do better on the testing and the mitigation as we go forward.
Well, Ramanan Lakshminarayan, Director of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics and Policy, both in Washington and New Delhi, and Ravi Agrawal, Managing Editor of Foreign Policy, and Barkha Dutt, Editor of the digital platform Mojo. My deep thanks to all three of you for joining us this hour. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or Environmental Social Governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.